This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you, in part, by Zola. Sponsors like Zola help keep the lights on here at The Bladder Presents, so keep an ear out for the Zola spot later in the show, and for a sponsor code that might save you some money. And now, the episode.
But a sociopath can live among you your whole life, and you don't know it till he eats you.
Was John Demjanjuk, Ivan the Terrible, the worst of the worst monster who presided over the Nazi gas chamber at Treblinka? Was he just an auto worker from Ukraine who had to endure one of the longest mistaken identity show trials in history? Or was he something in between? Netflix original The Devil Next Door presents the evidence. We'll discuss whether you should confront its testimony. Later, we're talking about a couple of long-form pieces on the wisdom of crowds when it comes to crime solving. One on the Vidoc Society, another on CrimeCon's Crime Solve. Pass those NDAs to the front of the room for The Bladder Presents, episode 121. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, a podcast that tries to find the true crime that's worth your time. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm joined by the podcast's chief Netflix property servicer, Stephanie Early Green. Welcome back, Stephanie.
Thank you. I like that.
Yeah, it's really true, especially lately. Thank you so much.
I can see how I'm spending my time.
I think that you asked whether I had seen the most wanted property we're discussing today before you had seen it. You may be having some regrets.
A little bit.
Yeah. Before we get into today's Most Wanted section, let me issue a content warning. The miniseries that we are discussing, The Devil Next Door, concerns the Holocaust and both the testimony of survivors and much of the imagery, particularly in the first couple of the episodes, is beyond horrifying, obviously. I don't believe there's any audio I'm using that's overly specific, but the subject generally is harrowing. So listeners, please be advised. And now, our Most Wanted section, once again, that's The Devil Next Door. It's a Netflix original series. It is available now. Here is the case file adapted from Wikipedia. John Demjanjuk, which is a name that I'm sure I'm only coming close to, sorry,
you got it,
was a Ukrainian-American auto worker accused of war crimes for having allegedly worked as a guard at Nazi extermination camps during World War II. Legal cases surrounding his alleged Nazi collaboration began during the 1970s, when eyewitness testimony from survivors identified him as the notorious and savagely violent Ivan the Terrible. These accusations led to Demjanjuk's deportation to Israel in 1986, where he was tried for crimes against humanity and convicted and sentenced to death. Demjanjuk never wavered in his claims that it was a case of mistaken identity, and an appeal got the verdict overturned for a while. I won't say any more because twists keep unfolding in this five-part miniseries. Stephanie, you expressed to me before we recorded that you weren't sure you could get too far into this. How many episodes did you end up enduring?
I actually watched the entire thing.
Okay.
Yeah. The first two, as you alluded to in the content warning, are pretty excruciating because they are so they're so heavy on the testimony of Holocaust survivors and imagery of the Holocaust. Once you get past those first two, it becomes more about how the actual case unfolded. And there, like you said, there are so many twists and turns that are there six episodes total?
Five.
Oh, okay. So the last three are more emotionally, I don't know, less emotionally taxing than the first two, at least for me. So.
Yeah, I agree. I think that generally speaking, I mean, the imagery is, as I said, horrifying. I think that that is its value, that is its own sort of testimony, and that if you can endure it as a viewer, that it's important to bear witness to the fact that this happened, especially in the current climate. Mm-hmm. worldwide, and with Holocaust deniers continuing to exist. Ugh. But I would say generally, difficulty of watching aside, it's fairly well built, but the central question of who exactly Demjanjuk was or was not, and did or did not do, and how he came to the States, and what he may have done before that, I feel like that lead was buried so far that it may never have actually been used. Would you agree?
Yeah, I do agree. I think that after watching the whole thing, it seems that the filmmakers were trying to unfold a narrative that was twisty and turny. And the way they did that was by withholding key elements of the case until late in the miniseries or the limited series, whatever we're calling it. But I understand why they did that, because at least for me, it does keep you watching for the last three. You're like, wait.
Oh yeah,
what?
For sure.
Cause things keep changing, but
yeah,
curiosity wise. And I wish they had done more upfront to establish whether maybe a point of view on whether this guy did or did not do what he's being accused of doing.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think the filmmakers probably have a point of view or a belief, to wit, that he may not have been Ivan the Terrible, but he was something.
Yes.
Like, he was not guiltless. His claim, I believe, and this is something that I did not get from the series. This is something I got from Googling. His claim was that he was a prisoner of war from 1942 to 1945. I believe he came to the U.S. in the early 50s. And there is some dispute as to whether that's true. But this is not like his version of, or accounting of, the years between 1942 and 1952 for him are not really explored by the film. But I think it's possible that they're trying to mirror an aspect of his trial in Israel, namely that perhaps the point is not what actually happened vis-a-vis him, but to testify to what happened generally, to testify to the Holocaust and the survivors' accounts. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yes, it does make sense. And to that point, the only time they explored his own accounting of his timeline during the war was through his testimony at the trial. So, you know, they relied so heavily on the evidence provided in the trial that they didn't sort of independently investigate the evidence presented, you know. It was all filtered,
which is, you know, it's a choice.
Yes,
to be like, our story is the trial, and we're not going to that the story isn't necessarily what he actually was. The story is the trial's exploration of who he was or wasn't and what happened, which is slightly different. I think some of the footage that they use from outside the trial in clip two might suggest that we're right, that the filmmakers are sort of trying to, like, the show trial is the show.
Yeah.
Here's clip two.
So much more than a trial of one man's guilt. This is a hearing of history.
When Eichmann was on trial, my mother made me watch it. Now Demjanjuk is on trial, and I want my child to watch it. This is the only safeguard we have that it never happens again.
I think that is the idea and the thrust of it. And I mean, there was this cultural preoccupation in the 70s and early 80s that I remember sort of vaguely, even in fiction and scripted stuff, about the exposing of Nazi war criminals in the States, and how we were running out of time to do that. Or like even The Boys from Brazil. Like, this was definitely a cultural preoccupation that I think no longer exists just because of how much time has passed. But, I think the series does a good job exploring the not need to revisit it, but the preoccupation with making sure that we got them all, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Although then at the end, they sort of, in the last, 10 minutes of the film, they delve into something that I wish they'd spent a lot more time on, which is
yes.
The U.S. government's complicity in sheltering Nazi war criminals, or at least Nazi participants in the war, who had hid out in the U.S. with the U.S. government's awareness of it.
Right.
And or beyond that,
weren't hiding.
Yeah. And beyond that, the way that the U.S. government used people who they knew had done bad things on the wrong side of the war, but because they were useful to us in other ways, the government turned a blind eye and didn't go after them as war criminals. And I really wish...
Yeah, we actually have a clip for that, which I'll just skip ahead okay. and play, because it's actually the same guy from our opening clip, who I believe was Demjanjuk's supervisor at the auto plant, who does have a certain pithy, sugar-free way of putting things.
I love that guy.
Yeah, he's rad. Here he is talking about Wernher von Braun, known Nazi and key founder of NASA.
You took a Nazi war criminal and put him in charge of our rocket program. This guy invented the rockets that were bombing England. But he got us to the moon. So he is a good Nazi.
I mean, unfortunately, you can't see his face while he's saying that, but you can imagine. There is the counter argument by Demjanjuk and his family and supporters is that it is a case of mistaken identity, and it's a Soviet attempt to screw over Ukraine somehow.
Can we talk
with
about
the United
that?
States is sorry go
no,
ahead
can we talk about that, because that explanation made no sense to me at all.
Yeah,
like it seems like a hell of a lot of work for the KGB to go after this one random Ukrainian American grandfather in Ohio as some sort of like global plot to sow division among Ukrainian Americans and Jewish Americans, who I don't think were in any danger of uniting anyway.
And then there was someone who was like, well, and once they did this, they would do the same to Estonians
right.
and Latvians.
Like,
I'm like, well,
also as if Ukrainian Americans are such a huge like political force within the U.S. Like they're not, as far as I know, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I have no concept in either direction, but I think that this was something that a man in this position during the Cold War could believably use as a defense, mm-hmm. that it's like, well, it's the Soviets trying to fuck with Ukraine, America, Ukrainian Americans, by forging documents badly. Like, I feel like the KGB would be better at it.
Yeah.
If this is what they were doing.
And wouldn't they try
someone would have been like, the staple
people?
Holes don't match up? I don't know.
I mean, wouldn't it be more widespread rather than, because there were, you know, Nazi collaborators hiding out in the U.S. after the war. If they wanted to, like, smear people, or I don't know, if they wanted to, like, do a more widespread campaign, they could have. Why just target this one dude? Like, it doesn't make sense.
I mean, yeah, no, it really doesn't make sense. And then the story, I will say, like, the fact that the story spans, like, the legal proceedings take long enough that the Berlin Wall falls during one of his appeals, and documents are unearthed in some basement in Kiev that suggests to the Israeli Supreme Court that it, you know, it's not beyond a reasonable doubt that he is this person. But then it's using the testimony of admitted camp guards. I mean, it just keeps spiraling outward and onward for decades. And it does create enough suspense that I didn't Google it until it was over, at least. So as hard as it was to get through and as frustrating as it was that the series wasn't addressing the facts of him, like the verifiable facts of his actual life, it was effective. It kept me from doing my own research, mm-hmm. which not every series can do.
Yeah, agreed.
Most of it, I would say, is devoted to the initial trial, or maybe that just felt like the longest part of it because it was so emotionally taxing, as you said, to get through. There's a moment in episode 2 where it becomes clear that some of the survivors must be mistaken. Mm-hmm. And I think the series does an excellent job implying that two things can be true, that they can be testifying to a true thing that happened to them, but also perhaps have the wrong man. And here's clip 3 in which one of the Israeli researchers, I believe, is just talking about the difficulty of eliciting this testimony from people who are older, perhaps beginning to forget things, and also that we just didn't know that much about the changeability of memory generally, but especially related to trauma. Here's clip 3.
There were moments when he was sharp and moments when he wasn't, and that was, of course, terribly distressing because you saw that these trials can't go on forever and that we're getting very close to the end of being able to have Holocaust survivors as witnesses.
There were some tough days in which we knew that we were facing some problems. The issue of the identification became more problematic. It was clear that not all of the procedures that were done in the best of manners.
Well, and I think that they were given a photo array and procedures that are used now in terms of having people pick somebody out of a photo array or a lineup were very different, mm-hmm. 30, 35 years ago. But once again, the series, I think, feels that resurfacing the testimony of Holocaust survivors was the most important aspect both of itself and of the trial.
Yeah.
So the last episode is sort of devoted to not discussing that exactly, but people sort of testifying to the testimony, which I think is worthwhile. But also at that point, I was really thinking, like, this man is in his 90s at this point in the series timeline. Are we actually going to find out one way or the other who he was and what he did? And I would say, I mean, what do you think? Where do you fall on where he fell?
Well, like I said, I was ping-ponging back and forth between, well, maybe he didn't do it. Well, I think he did. Oh, maybe not. I think he did. And by the end of it, I was pretty convinced he was definitely a Nazi. I mean, he had that SS tattoo, which is pretty damning, in my opinion.
And his explanation for it was risible.
Laughable. Yeah, so, and like, yeah. Why? And he knew he when he filled out his immigration card to the U.S., he said he came from like Sobibor, right? Which
right.
was a concentration camp. And then he also knew about a random town outside of Treblinka. Like he knew a lot for a guy who claimed that he knew nothing, you know? So I think he was definitely,
it was a lot of coincidences in terms of references that were damning.
Yeah. He was definitely a Nazi in my opinion. And, probably was Ivan the Terrible. I mean, the series goes back and forth about presenting kind of, competing evidence from both sides about his identity card, for example, and, you know, whether the picture was him and then whether the identity card itself was forged and whether it looked like other Nazi identification cards from the time and whatever. And then there was some hullabaloo about his name and how really, based on these other documents, Ivan the Terrible was named Ivan Marchenko, not Ivan Demyanyuk. But then it turns out his mother's maiden name was Marchenko. Well, that's a heck of a coincidence. Mm. All this stuff.
Yeah.
So in the end, I'm like, he probably was this dude that he is accused of being. And this might sound, well, this isn't based in evidence. This is more of a feeling. When I saw his grandson talking. So look, his family, they are not complicit in his crimes if he committed them because they were born after the war. They probably did not think he was a Nazi. But his kids and his grandkids gave the impression, and this is, maybe this will sound terrible, but this is just my feeling, they gave the impression of being callous enough to have been raised by a former Nazi. I mean, when I was listening to the grandson in particular talk about, well, look, like he did what he had to do during the war and you would have done the same thing. And I don't care if he was a death camp guard. I'm like, you might not know it, but you were probably like indirectly raised by someone who was a Nazi and it's coming through in your attitude toward the world. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And there it is. I wish they had gotten more into this, but the series strongly implies that in order to continue funding his defense, because these proceedings went on and on and on, that they were accepting money from unsavory at best groups, including, it was implied, the Klan. So, you know, I have some compassion for what it must be like to see this, you know, doting parent and grandparent spirited away to another country to stand trial for absolutely the worst possible crimes. But I really was not impressed by the grandson being like, look, it was a long time ago. He's changed. Like,
and also he said, I don't care if he did it. Essentially, that was his attitude. Yeah. If he did it, he had to do it. It's like, look, I mean, banality of evil, I get it. We all like have the potential to do evil things when put into a situation of evil, but not everyone becomes death camp guards, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was actually fairly easy to avoid becoming that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there, but I'm also not going to sit there and defend like, oh, well, I don't care what he did. Like, well, you should.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have to. Mm-hmm. We as a, you know, culture, we as a society are all answerable to things that happened in the past. My feeling is I just don't know if he's this guy, but I think he was involved somehow. And I think that this experience, it just seems like such a small word, but this experience is something that the survivors carry in the body, so to say. And I think they did recognize him, maybe not from where they thought.
Mm.
Maybe they transposed him with someone else, but I feel that it was someone that they recognized.
Yeah.
And I think that this entire trial was like, if you're trying to get at this truth, it's impossible. It's not necessarily about him.
Yeah.
It's about trying to support and believe these people who, you know, I do believe them.
Yeah.
So, but there's also, I mean, the judges were just an impossible position. Certainly you're not going to hear that testimony day after day and then be like, well, it's hard to say. Mm-hmm. Like, what else can you do? And we do have a clip about that, but actually I'm going to skip to one from the last episode where a local reporter and Demyanyuk's, in my opinion, over-involved son-in-law are talking about how it's cruel to continue persecuting an old man who is ill. P.S. They found out that these histrionics were fake and he was for a man in his late 80s getting around pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Here's clip five.
People were stunned that the government continued to go after geriatric men for what they did years earlier.
What kind of a threat did you see on that old man? What harm to society did he pose to anybody?
I was talking to a federal prosecutor. I said, the Holocaust was 50 years ago.
When will the government ultimately stop? He looked me right in the eye and he said, when these men take their last dying breaths.
I mean, leaving aside the hypocrisy of federal prosecutors on this particular point, I mean, the Holocaust was 50 years ago? Fuck off. Like, who cares if it was 500 years
ago? Yeah, and why does being old absolve you of responsibility for war crimes? All it means is that you survived and other people didn't. You managed to cockroach your way into decrepitude, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't be held to account. I mean, that
flawless.
And then that one guy, the man who was just talking, he seemed like affronted by the fact that the U.S. government, well, some people in the U.S. government would want to continue prosecuting Nazis until they were, you know, all rooted out. And he was like, that just seemed, his tone suggested he felt sorry for them. I'm like, what? Like, I'm just, I don't get it. I don't get the
yeah,
idea
that it's just like, well, you know, he did his time. Like, he wasn't a fucking gentleman bank robber.
Yeah.
Like, Germany charged him with 27,000 plus counts of accessory to murder.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're not talking about a like an old bat who's shoplifting here.
Yeah.
He was a Nazi war criminal. If the government is going to continue to the ends of, you know, to the end of time with anything, it's got to be this.
Of course.
Yeah. So I just found that, like, for a reporter to be like, so I asked the guy, what's the fucking point of this? Like, oh my God, really?
Yeah.
Good. But I mean, there's a lot to be horrified by in this. There's a lot to be disgusted by in this. And I mean, I think it is excellent testimony and suspenseful and twisty, perhaps a little cynical in the way they drop the episode ends, but it is, you know, it's not quite 5 hours of your life. And again, with content caution, I recommend it. I think it's good. A little frustrating, but good.
Yeah.
Once again, The Devil Next Door, it is currently available on Netflix. And again, content caution. So before we move on to our cold case, a word from our sponsor. Our sponsor today is Zola. What is Zola? Zola, the wedding company that will do anything for love, is reinventing the wedding planning and registry experience to make the happiest moment in couples' lives even happier. From engagement to wedding and decorating your first home, Zola is there, combining compassionate customer service with modern tools and technology, all in the service of love. Zola takes the stress out of wedding planning with free wedding websites, the easiest wedding registry, affordable invite suites, and more. You start with a free wedding site. It takes just minutes to set up and customize. You can add photos, meet cute stories, and even recommendations for things to do for your out-of-town guests. And the FAQ section can take the awkward out of questions like, are the kids invited, and do I have a plus one? Just point your guests to the frequently asked questions. Your Zola registry is on your wedding website too, so guests can get info and buy gifts in one place. And Zola is the only place you can register for honeymoon funds and gift cards along with physical gifts. Guests will love the free shipping, smart returns, price matching, group gifting, and more. And couples will love the best completion discount around. 20% off for 6 months after your wedding day, and you can use it as much as you want. And explore Zola's invites. Thousands of designs, friendly prices, and an entire suite of related products from save the dates and invitations to thank you notes. I wish I had had Zola when I got married instead of the spreadsheet Hydra I was working with. Having everything in one place would really have helped my sanity. You can ask Dan. But until Dan and I renew our vows, at least I can offer a promo to Blotter Presents listeners. Build your free wedding website on Zola and get $50 toward your registry. Just go to zola.com/blotter and get started today. That's zola.com/blotter, B-L-O-T-T-E-R, for $50 toward your registry. zola.com/blotter. Thank you so much, Zola. And now, on to our cold case section. Prompted by a piece from Crime Report last week by Andrea Cipriano. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's called My Weekend as an Amateur Cold Case Detective. We're going to talk about that, as well as another piece from The Telegraph in 2009 on the Vidocq Society and the wisdom of crowds when it comes to trying to solve, or some critics might say, interfering in, often with prurient intent, cold cases. So let's start with that Crime Report piece, qua the piece. I understand that they were not allowed to share too much of the details of the cases that they were tasked with at this con, but I also felt like this piece was a little surface and could have gotten more into the ethical implications of a group of people basically crime solving for fun on real cases. Mm-hmm. I also feel like this author apparently is going to John Jay in forensic psychology, and I'm not sure she's cut out for that. Here's a quote from the piece. The 2.5 hours I spent profiling individuals related to Nancy's case was not easy for me because I found it emotionally taxing. As a forensic psychology student, I felt fully equipped and up for the task of identifying a person of interest's MMO against a suspect profile, but these are real. It might be time to divert from that career path. What did you think of this piece generally?
It left me with a lot of questions. I wanted more kind of nuts and bolts information about how the organizers of this conference got the case files. Like, what's the mechanism by which, like, law enforcement cooperates with this, if at all? I'm assuming there has to be some collaboration with law enforcement for them to be able to get any case file information, but, like, how? I want more information on the mechanics of it. I also wanted to see a copy of the NDA because I can't imagine you get a conference center or, like, you know, a huge auditorium full of people and get them to sign an NDA to, quote, respect the victims' families, and that's going to work. I mean, also...
Well, and then there was an explicit warning, apparently, at one point from one of the, I guess, detectives related to one of the cases who said, like, please don't put this on social media or... Or I guess it was a conference organizer who's like, please don't put any of this on social media or use the hashtag, or law enforcement is not going to trust us and we won't be able to keep doing these.
Right.
Like, well, I, like you, would like to know why law enforcement decided to go along with this in either of the two cases that they were looking at, how those cases were selected, what the conference organizers had to sign in order to get access to this stuff, how they felt they were going to control it on social media. Like, I didn't necessarily see anything about it, but I also wasn't looking for it. You have to wonder how desperate law enforcement is, or sort of despairing that they're ever going to find anything, that they would turn it over to a bunch of...
I mean, I wonder how much of this was driven by the desperation of the victims' families.
That's another aspect. And yeah, she doesn't... There's a little sticky writing mm-hmm. about...
And she also seems very earnest and like...
Young,
she and like real young. She sort of has drunk the Kool-Aid that of this particular event. And she said, this is a quote, "I can confidently say that I believe we made meaningful advancements in both cases." Like, well, why do you know that or think that. I mean, the proof's in the pudding. Like, let's give it a minute. She wrote this like a day after the thing.
Well, and yeah, as far as drinking the Kool-Aid is concerned, the other quote that I thought was telling was, at CrowdSolve, beyond getting access to confidential police files, you get to see the human side of cases. ... about quick Google searches, and then, but those articles won't tell you who Karen was.
Yeah.
Like, look, I absolutely agree that the true crime genre has started doing a better job foregrounding the victims in these case studies or narratives. That's great. But there is a certain kind of, I don't know, just namby, pamby, like, well, that won't tell you who Karen was. Like, you've been listening to too much 48 Hours.
Yeah.
Voiceover is what that is. And stop doing CrowdSolve's PR for them.
And
because this is a for-profit endeavor that is related to CrimeCon. Again, your mileage may vary as to whether you think that's ethical or classless or whatever. I don't think I would participate in something like that, but I also have no free time. Like, I'm not trying to say that I'm better than anyone, but I think there are a lot of questions about crime cons generally, and about something like this, and about, honestly, any subreddit devoted to trying to solve cold cases that's like, is this, what is this for?
Yeah. Did you go on the website for CrowdSolve?
I did not. How was that?
Well, the Oxygen Network is like front and center, and
well, I think they are funding it.
Yeah,
basically.
But the way it looks like, you know, just an offshoot of a TV network, and like the event itself was packaged like as an entertainment experience. I think the exact wording they used was if you participate, you're participating in a quote true crime experience. And that seems kind of gross. Like, it's not a murder mystery dinner, you know, like it's actual murders.
It's real people. Yeah.
And I get that. I mean, at least this author seemed earnestly interested in like helping to solve the crime. And I'm sure a lot of people do enter into something like this with pure intentions. But I think a lot of people, there is like a rubbernecking aspect. Like, you want to like get the gory details of a crime that you wouldn't be able to get otherwise. And like, I don't know, it puts me in mind of like Missing Maura Murray, like those guys. I mean, it wouldn't be The Blotter Presents if I didn't bring them up like once every five times I come on this podcast. But you know, just the like kind of, yeah, like you said, prurient like interest in other people's misfortune.
Well, then I feel like maybe prurient is too harsh,
strong, yeah.
But it's like whatever the know-it-all equivalent is of prurience.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. So,
because I'm as big a know-it-all as anyone. And after whatever, a Saturday evening marinating in the four datelines that have stacked up on the downstairs DVR because we're too lazy to pick out something, you know, good to watch. It's like you really start thinking that you know better than law enforcement, or you just read enough like fucking Zodiac crackpot theories and you're like, well, look, it was obviously such and so.
Yeah.
And since people are going to be doing that on Reddit anyway, I can see, I may not approve, but I can see how Oxygen is like, well, this is going to happen anyway. Let's spin it off.
Right. Yeah.
And find a way to tell ourselves, and for everyone who participates, to tell themselves that this is a more altruistic experience than just obsessing over a given case or, you know, being nosy.
Yeah, nosy in the privacy of your own home.
Yeah, exactly. And you sort of don't inflict it on... You don't inflict it on anyone else.
Yeah.
But with that said, I don't I think if victims' families are really frustrated and feel like there's not going to be any progress made and desperate times, etc., I don't think in the abstract, throwing it open to a room full of people who might have a new perspective on it is the worst idea. I'm just not sure what my comfort level is with the oxygen network being the aegis under which this all takes place. I don't know.
Also, should there be some sort of, you know, filtering mechanism for who gets to participate?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what
I overlooked this, but was this correspondent there as press? I don't think she was.
No, I don't. She didn't say that.
Yeah.
It sounded like she, you know, did this for under her own steam, but I don't know.
Yeah. And we really didn't hear anything about the other participants that I can recall. I mean, like a couple of things, but she also had contact with one of the family members and, you know, wrote about that gently. But I didn't get a good sense of what this was actually like. And I feel like perhaps they should have sent someone with a little more time covering this field.
Yeah.
To really give us a better, like a higher perspective, like from higher up.
Yeah, I agree.
But that will be linked in the show notes. It's definitely like worth reading, but it raises more questions than it answers.
Yeah,
certainly. The flip side of a true crime experience like this is the Vidoc Society. That may actually be Vidoc. I am not French. It was founded in 1990. It meets every third Thursday in Philadelphia, and its members include forensic scientists, DAs, active and retired police, Interpol, etc. What the Telegraph's Adam Higginbotham described in his 2009 article as, quote, a brains trust of retired and working criminologists. Members must be invited to join. Cases under consideration must be more than 2 years old, and the victims must not have been engaged in criminal activity, which feels a little wrong to me, although I think that measure is primarily to control the sheer volume of cases under consideration by the society. I feel like enough shows have procedurals have played on this that I thought the society itself and its existence was much more common knowledge than it actually is, because you had not heard of it.
Yeah, but in some ways I have managed to live under like very selective rocks, so don't... don't base anything on my knowledge of something, but I mentioned it to my mom, who, like, when I was growing up was like the biggest true crime reader I knew. And she, like, you know, welcomed me into the Society of True Crime aficionados, but she knew about it and like was very familiar with it. So I think I might just be, not have been paying attention or something.
I believe briefly there was a show based on it. They didn't call it this. It was like, and it was amateurs, but it starred Christian Slater. And it was basically like the living room Vidoc Society. And he was a disgraced cop who, you know, was something to prove, blah, blah, blah. It was canceled in like six episodes. I was the one who watched them all. Even Christian Slater was like, that sucked. I'm not watching it. I thought this article was much more what I was looking for from the crime report piece, that it describes how the society was founded, what it's trying to do. It makes it clear that like the founders are not really comfortable talking about their rate of solving cold cases. And I thought this was a good overview. I assume everything, even though the piece is 10 years old, I assume that everything in it is functionally true. Maybe they moved the meeting time, but it's not like you and I are getting invited. So I guess it doesn't really matter.
Unfortunately.
Unless you want to like meet in Philadelphia and wander around looking for them. I guess we could do that.
Yeah.
What did you think of this piece overall? Did you get a good sense of?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. It really, I mean, the contrast between Vidoc and CrowdSolve in terms of like legitimacy was pretty stark, because Vidoc, like their membership, it's actual people with some sort of bona fides in terms of solving crimes. So like, you know,
yeah,
former prosecutors or detectives or forensic scientists. Like you said, a brain trust. So I thought it sounded really interesting. I'd love to like be a fly on the wall during one of those meetings.
Me too. I believe that early in the Vidoc Society's life, civilians brought cases in more often.
Yeah, now it's almost all law enforcement, right?
Now it's almost all like at least law enforcement adjacent. And you're definitely seeing a more underserved communities in terms of funding and the size of the Bureau of Intelligence in the state. Here's a quote from the piece. "We'll never see the FBI or the New York City police bring a case to us," says Vidoc's chairman, Fred Bornhofen, a 70-year-old private security consultant and former spook for the Office of Naval Intelligence. Okay. "But we'll get all the state and town cases because they just don't have the training, background, or sophistication to handle it," end quote. So great. It's great that they have this resource, but reading these two articles back to back, I found myself wanting some kind of hybrid organization that's like the Academy of the Wisdom of Crowds or something, where civilians like myself could bring a famous unsolved case from near where I grew up, Jeanette De Palma, to a society like this. Like, you apply to have the right to present, and then you have like a basically a thesis defense, and then they put their heads together, and then they kind of like spit out a précis after an hour or two. It's like, here's what we think probably happened.
How would that work with like, case evidence though? Like, how would a civilian get access to the necessary case file stuff in order to make that presentation?
Well, I think now that I'm inventing this imaginary society on the spot, I think that you would apply, hopefuls would apply to present to the group, to the society, all of whom are still law enforcement, criminologists, DAs, and so on. If your presentation is accepted and bank, then the group, then the panel gets access to the case files. You don't necessarily see it, but you're sort of like, here's why I think this is worthy of your consideration.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Here's how cold the case is. Here's how it played into weird fucking North Jersey satanic panic horseshit of the turn of the 80s. You know, they've still never figured out so on and so forth. Here's where you would find the files. And then if I'm like elected to present, then they get the case files and I would get some of them in order to do the presentation, I guess.
Got it. Yeah, I would like that too.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, now I'm just thinking of all these cases, although, oh my God, can you imagine being the like admissions officer of this imaginary academic group, that it's like, if we get one more Zodiac application, oh, I'm stepping out of this window.
Yeah, that's true. They'd probably have to have like a no fly list of cases you're not allowed to submit.
Yeah, that it's like, I actually think Charles Manson was like a trapdoor opens. Or like, if you try to sneak in some Jack the Ripper theorizing in your presentation, they just like,
it's an automatic disqualification. It's like,
yeah, it's like, you can't do that on television. They just green slime you and you're done.
Yeah.
Anything else on this before we wrap up?
Nope. I agree with you. We need some middle ground, but because you and I aren't getting into either of these things, one voluntarily, yeah, the other not so.
Exactly. So yes, universe, we're putting it out there. Please get, I don't know, crime doc, something, some hybrid of this, just so I can get some answers on some of my cases that have been preoccupying me for a long time. Once again, that article is from The Telegraph in 2009, and that will be in our show notes, along with the crime report piece. and a roundup from WBUR of like citizen sleuths online and pieces about that stuff. Stephanie, this one was sort of all over the place. Thanks.
Thank you.
For helping me try to corral everything.
Yeah,
once again.
Anytime.
In local news today, bees.
Because I've lost the siren sound effect forever. Stephanie, where else can listeners find you these days?
On my blog, stephanieearlygreen.com. It was my main place.
Excellent. Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for coming back.
You too.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Let Us Give Thanks, as Toby Ball returns for Slow Burn's third season on Biggie and Tupac, plus the CBC's podcast, Hunting Warhead. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram. And at Eve Beatty's and my true crime review newsletter, Best Evidence. That's bestevidence.fyi. If you like the podcast, I'd love it if you tell a friend and rate it on your podcast app of choice. This episode was sponsored in part by Zola, so visit zola.com/blotter for $50 towards your registry. My guest has been Stephanie Early Green, and she is on Twitter at @ateffy. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.